It's now been 7 years since an Australian government included a gender impact statement with the delivery of a federal budget. Women's groups have been lobbying hard for its reinstatement ahead of this year's May budget. And despite our repeated requests to clarify if it will be included, we've had no official response as yet. However, its inclusion does seem unlikely, with Women's Economic Security Minister Jane Hume signalling late last month that the government would not be applying a gender lens to the budget. So what is a gender impact statement and what purpose does it serve? With me is Dr. Anne Summers, journalist and author with a long involvement in feminism, who advised Prime Ministers Hawke and Keating on women's issues, including being involved with the introduction of the first women's budget program in 1984. My other guest is Miranda Stewart, professor at Melbourne University Law School and honorary professor at the ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy. Miranda and Anne, welcome to you both. And if I may start with you, Dr. Summers, can you take me through, if you wouldn't mind, the history of the Women's Budget Program and when and why it all began?
Very happy to, Michael. But just before I do, can I just clarify something that you said in the introduction? And that is sure. The gender impact statement. You said it's 7 years since we've had one. I would argue that it's a much, much longer period than that. And I can sort of take you through what happened, but there hasn't really been a gender impact statement of the kind that was created in 1984, I should say, and was then known as the Women's Budget Program, which was unfortunately discontinued by the Keating government in about 94, I think it was, or 95. But what happened in 1984, the newly elected Hawke government had, particularly under the influence of Susan Ryan, who was Minister for the Status of Women, assisting the Prime Minister, as well as being Minister for Education, she had persuaded the Labor government that they should include in all of their cabinet submissions an impact on women's statement. So the cover page of every cabinet submission had a couple of lines in which departments had to describe the impact on women, whether positive or negative, of whatever the proposal was that was going forward. And Prime Minister Hawke decided that he wanted a mechanism similar to that to influence all government thinking and policy making. And so he asked Sir Geoffrey Yeend, who was the head of the Prime Minister's department, to devise such a solution. And Sir Geoffrey convened a meeting of all of the, they were known as permanent heads in those days, the departmental secretaries, for like Treasury and Foreign Affairs and Defence, and all the big guys were there around the table, and I was in the room, and he came up with the proposal that there be a special budget document in which departments would be required to report on what they were doing policy-wise to advance the status of women and how their existing and proposed policies would impact on women. And it was an incredibly radical idea, but because it came from a very conservative man who was the head of the Prime Minister's department, everybody said, okay, let's do it. And you know, within a few months, the first budget statement, the first year, it was quite a small document. I think only 13 departments contributed to it, but it was a proper budget paper. It looked like the rest of the budget, you know, it had its own volume, but it looked like a Treasury document, which indeed it was. The following year, when we had a full year to prepare one, it was a 300-page document and a very, very substantial one.
So Hawke ran with the idea, but then Keating dropped it, and then Howard took it up again. So can you just explain in that intervening time what was behind those decisions, and if at the moment of that reinstatement by Howard as well, whether this incorporation into the budget had actually seen any tangible benefits flowing to women?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, Michael. I was no longer working for Keating when it was dropped. I like to think if I'd still been there, it mightn't have happened. But anyway, I don't know the reasons. I wasn't there. But I do dispute that Howard resuscitated it. What he did was that he introduced a new document, which he called a women's statement. And basically what it did was to go through the budget and highlight any initiatives that could considerably be portrayed as being positive for women. It was no longer a budget document. It was just a pamphlet, basically, that was produced on budget night. And you know, it was a propaganda tool, and that was what survived through the Rudd-Gillard years, and eventually was killed by Tony Abbott. I'm not quite sure what year he did that, but I mean, it stopped being a budget document and a forensic tool for analysing current and prospective policy, and instead became a, if you like, a PR document for making the government look good about what it had already done, regardless of whether or not it did have a positive impact on women.
I might bring in Miranda Stewart here. Miranda Stewart, in terms of naming this particular document within the federal budget, I think you prefer the term gender budget analysis as opposed to its former title of women's budget program. Can you explain why?
Yes. Hi, Michael. And look, let me just say it's an honour to be on the program with Dr. Summers. I should just pay dues to her as one of the people who was really so influential and important in the initial steps that were done in the 1980s, which were globally influential, I should say, Australia's work at that time. Well, look, things have changed since the 70s and the 80s somewhat, although we haven't really headed towards equality yet, which is in some ways what this is all about. My preference, I suppose, as a kind of an academic, but also as a kind of policy analytical tool, is probably to use the word gender these days, which is not to say I'm not in support of women's equality, right? So we would still be advocating for that. Because the tool is really intended to be a way to analyse how, as Anne said, how existing policy impacts differentially on women and men, on different genders in the economy, because different genders are situated differently in households, in work, in family, in study and so on, in terms of physical safety. And so policy always has a differential effect, and we really need to understand that different gender impact of policy in order to do good budgeting, right? In order to design policy that supports all Australians, that delivers expenditure fairly to all Australians, and that also does actually achieve equality over time.
Can I just ask on that? Because I think you make a really interesting point there, and that is that surely any budget implicitly has to address the very needs that you've just outlined without calling it a separate document. Isn't that inherent in every budget that should be delivered?
Look, you're right, of course, but I guess what you have to be careful about is not to confuse what is a facially neutral document. So I have to confess that I've had some members of the policy world in government in the past, usually men, say to me, but the budget is for everyone. You know, it's neutral, right? It's for all Australians. And of course, that's true. But for it to be genuinely for all Australians, it has to take account of the different situation. Not actually only of women and men, although that would be the most important and dominant difference in the economy still today, but also rural and urban, ethnic and racial differences and so on. So these things are all crucial, I would say, to really understanding and designing good policy and to properly allocating expenditure to achieve fair outcomes.
So I think Anne Summers alluded to some of the history of when this document stopped being included in the budget. Can you add any more light to that as to what happened? I think, was it under the Abbott-Hockey government that that statement stopped being actually included?
I think it was in 2014, from memory, that Prime Minister Abbott stopped publishing what was then called, I think, a women's budget statement, but perhaps just a women's statement. I think Anne's correct that this document had kind of lost value over the previous decade or more because it really did become a sort of publicity tool. Now, on one view, that is a part of budgeting, is to communicate policy to the public. You know, that transparency is important, and emphasising that there should be expenditures devoted to deal with violence against women or to encourage women's sport. I mean, these are not bad things, right? These are good things. But the document really did not do the kind of analysis and strategic policy planning and indicators and outcomes that Anne is referring to. It had stopped doing that. It's interesting that some civil society organisations outside government then picked it up. In particular, the National Foundation for Australian Women started publishing a gender lens after the budget was released every year.
And ACOS, I think, has been involved as well. And I'm wondering if those organisations outside the processes of government have flown the flag for that sort of aspect or facet of budgeting. Why is it we need the document reinstated? What's the argument for bringing it back?
from my point of view, it's great to have civil society organisations, women's equality organisations and so on, scrutinising the budget, producing reports, doing an analysis, calling the government to account. But of course, it's government itself which makes policy, which does expenditure decisions, which cuts programmes or expands programmes, and which can actually control the direction of the budget. And so, of course, it has to be an internal and fully led programme, really, ideally, out of Treasury and Prime Minister's office.
Anne Summers, can I come back to you on this? Because it sounds to me, in terms of the historical perspective of this inclusion in the budget, it very quickly became, from your perspective, somewhat of a hollow document, a public relations exercise. So if we are to bring it back within the internal machinations of budget delivery, what does it have to include for you to feel like it's doing its job?
Well, I mean, I think as Miranda said, I mean, the work that's been done by the NGOs, particularly the National Foundation for Women, analysing budgets after the event is, of course, very valuable. But that can only ever be a tool that scrutinises what the decisions that have already been made. I mean, what a proper budget does is that it makes decisions about expenditure and about policy, and it has the authority and the financial ability to make those things happen. And that's why they have to happen from within government. And I mean, the thing about the sort of the more propaganda type statements that used to come out on budget night that Abbott got rid of, I mean, they were there simply to publicise events that the government thought made them look good. What the budget, a real budget document should do, whether you call it a gender lens or a women's budget program, I'm not really fussed about the name, but it's the process and the mechanism that's important. And what it should be doing is to be developing policy that is gender neutral, or that takes into account the disadvantages of particular groups, and in this case we're talking about the group of women, in their ability to participate in society because of various impediments. I mean, last year's budget, you know, was analysed by a number of women's groups as having, you know, a substantial number of shortcomings when it came to assisting women, when it comes to things like childcare and employment participation and so on. These are criticisms of a budget that's just been brought down. What I'm arguing for, and I think what the people who favour this generally are advocating, is that there be a process within government, that it become part of the normal budget formation processes, for the impact on women or the gender lens to be a part of the decision-making process. So it's not just a publicity document, it's a document that helps develop policy and, where necessary, remedies existing policy to make it fairer.
So a document of real intent. And with regard to that, if I may just finish up with you, Professor Miranda Stewart, if this was to appear as part of the May budget for 2021, what are some of the key areas that you think that kind of addition to the budget should be addressing when it comes to areas where women are no doubt being affected post-COVID?
Yes, you're right to raise COVID as having had actually some differential economic impact on women and men. Look, I think it's the things that the people would expect that are actually out in the public domain, because these are issues of concern to many people. So in particular, women's workforce participation is still a big economic challenge for Australia. This is something that, you know, and some of us were writing about decades ago, and we know that it still would be good for all Australian families if we had better childcare provision, more universal care, more universal support to enable women's full exercise of their human capital, if you like, engagement in the workforce over time. And so policies that would support that, and policies that would in particular also look at the sex segregated nature of the workforce. So we have a very concentrated gender specific workforce in Australia, you know, mostly men in construction, mostly men in engineering, mostly women in primary education and so on. And these things operate over time to the disadvantage of women. And so policies that really took these problems seriously are actually going to benefit all Australians over time.
I was going to say, I mean, if you address these inequalities, then even at a most pragmatic level, surely that boosts the long-term bottom line of our national economy.
there's been plenty of analysis done now, economic analysis outside government. KPMG's done it. The Grattan Institute has done it. So economic modelling, also Foundation for Australian Women had some modelling done. It seems pretty clear that it would boost the economy. You have more taxpayers, more consumption, more income coming into households. And you also support women's economic security in terms of long-term life course protection, not being poor in old age. And that reduces the pressure on the budget as well over time.
Final word from you, Ann Summers. Yes.
Could I just jump in to strongly endorse what Miranda's just said? I mean, the financial and fiscal benefits of increasing women's workforce participation, you know, as she says, have been documented countless times, would bring billions of extra dollars into the economy and boost GDP by as much as, you know, 7 or 8%. And so we would definitely all be better off. But the other point I would make is that to do a budget of this kind can't be done in a few weeks. I mean, it takes months and months and months. And the first one we did in 84, which I think we had about 6 months to do it, was not long enough to include all departments. So I think even if this government wanted to do something, and they've made it pretty obvious that they don't, there's not much time to do a comprehensive, you know, gender a neutral budget. Maybe they can, you know, work in one or two policy areas if they wanted to demonstrate that they actually care about women's equality. And I wish they would do that. But, you know, the benefits for the nation are tangible and unarguable. And the benefits for women themselves, of course, are fantastic.
Well, let's hold these thoughts then, and perhaps they can be applied and find themselves to be more pertinent and germane to the May 2022 budget. Let's see if we can do something there.
Exactly.
In the meantime, it's been great to speak to both of you. Thanks very much indeed for taking the time here on Life Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Ann Summers, journalist and author with a long involvement in feminism, who advised Prime Ministers Hawke and Keating on women's issues and was involved in the introduction of the first women's budget in 1984, and as well Professor Miranda Stewart, who works at the Melbourne University Law School, honorary professor at the ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy. You're with Life Matters, Michael McKenzie with you, and in a moment, a very special episode.